This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America.
Hello, welcome to VOA Africa. Thank you for joining us. I'm Nabil Biagio, and here's what's coming up.
If that is not addressed, it will not only end up creating inconvenience in cities, but at the same time, the open burning is causing outdoor pollution.
That's Richard Munang, Deputy Regional Director of the United Nations Environment Programme's Africa Office, on the need to deal with plastic pollution and the burning of waste. All this and more coming up on Africa News Tonight. As the civil war in Ethiopia rages on, the head of the main hospital in the Tigray region's capital says two airstrikes this morning have killed at least 10 people. Fred Harder reports from Addis Ababa, Ethiopia.
The first airstrike hit Mekele, the regional capital of Ethiopia's Tigray region, at around 7:30 a.m. Wednesday morning, according to Dr. Kibrom Gebreselassie, the director of the flagship Ada Hospital in the capital. The Tigray region's leadership and doctors at the hospital say the Ethiopian government is using drones for the latest attacks. VOA could not independently verify these allegations. The second occurred shortly afterward. According to Dr. Kibrom, the attacks hit a residential part of the city, attacking civilians. In total, he said, 10 deaths have been confirmed so far. Hospital officials said that other cases were being rushed to surgery at both Ida and the nearby Mekele General Hospital. A surgeon at Ida Hospital told the Reuters news agency that the first strike hit rescuers who were trying to help people injured by the first attack. Wednesday's airstrikes are the latest of several to hit Mekele since the fighting resumed in Tigray in late August. The hostilities ended a truce declared by the federal government in March, which had allowed much-needed aid supplies to reach the northern region. On Sunday, the Tigray regional leadership called for a cessation of hostilities and said they had set up a team of mediators ready to enter peace talks with the federal government, which has yet to formally respond to the statement. Since then, heavy fighting has been reported along Tigray's northern, southern, and western borders. Fred Harter for VOA News, Addis Ababa, Ethiopia.
The UK continues to mourn Queen Elizabeth II, whose coffin arrived in London's Westminster Hall today. VOA's Central Africa Service reporter Venus Shimiamana tells me the members of the African diaspora in the UK have mixed sentiments about the death of the Queen, the history of the monarchy and its role in today's world.
As we speak, Queen Elizabeth's coffin has arrived in the Palace of Westminster, in Westminster Hall, where she will lie in state for 4 days. The procession was solemn from Buckingham Palace. We have seen Big Ben tolling every 60 seconds, and the King Charles and his siblings walking behind the coffin, which was carried on a gun carriage. Members of the public who travelled to London from all corners of this kingdom will be able to pay their tribute and respect to the Queen until Monday, the day of her state funeral, which will be attended by head of state, head of government, queens and princesses, and other members of the public.
And how is the African diaspora responding to the death of Queen Elizabeth and events these days in the UK?
I would say the older generation is paying a tribute to the Queen they have known all their lives, who has somehow contributed in shaping their lives and offered to them the opportunities available on this land. And there is the younger generation, the generation which is in search of their identity, like the Windrush generation. Although some paid tribute to her legacy, for others, the monarchy is seen as an institution with a dark history of colonialism and economic degradation. The younger generation want a reckoning with the past.
Speaking of the younger generation wanting a reckoning with the past, some of the global hashtags making rounds on social media these days are abolish the monarchy and not my king. Do you see any resonance with the conversations the African diaspora is having in Britain following the death of Queen Elizabeth?
You have seen, you have said, I mean, those who have been going around, even putting those kind of messages on bus stops in some part of these kingdoms, saying that we don't want even, we have seen where they were saying that we don't want the Prince of Wales, we don't want the monarchy. There have been protests, people protesting against the monarchy, even in this period where we should be all mourning.
There has been an incident in the UK, which is some think might have been racially motivated, the shooting and killing of 24-year-old Chris Scabba by British police in South London a few days ago. What is going on regarding that, and how has it influenced conversations Black people and Africans are having in the UK right now?
Of course, the shooting of Scabba was in the news because the whole UK was mourning the death of the Queen. And this, of course, brings up again the issue of racism in this country. I would say that for the African diaspora, what is matter more, the African diaspora is not much into royalty. They are more into looking for opportunities, not only for them, because Britain has been hit hard by the energy crisis and the financial inflation. So they are mourning the Queen now, but they are waiting to see what the King is bringing tomorrow to reassure them, to offer them more opportunities for life.
That was reporter Nshime Amana speaking with me from London this past hour. In Angola, the near defeat of ruling People's Movement for the Liberation of Angola, MPLA, in recent elections has sparked hope but also concern about the country's future. The MPLA's old civil war enemy, the National Union for the Total Independence of Angola, UNITA, argued it had won the vote. But the Constitutional Court dismissed the challenge and President João Lourenço was sworn in for a second term in office. Darren Taylor has more.
The MPLA has governed the oil-rich nation for almost five decades, but the last few elections show its support declining. The official result from the latest poll says it won 51% of votes, down 10% on its 2017 showing. The MPLA's worst performance since multi-party democracy started in Angola in 1992.
They were below 50% in the capital, Luanda, which is an MPLA heartland, and it would have been almost unthinkable for Luandans to not vote for the MPLA 20 years ago.
Analyst for Africa-Asia Dialogues, Ayesha Kaji, says UNITA's making huge gains, even with the political system weighted against it. According to Angola's Electoral Commission, it received 44% of the recent vote, up from just 27% 5 years ago. It's a strong indication, says Kaji, that Angolans no longer want a government that uses violence against opponents, does little to develop the country, and rigs elections. These are all charges the MPLA denies. Kaji says the MPLA is making the same mistake as other former liberation movements turned governments in Africa, trading on its reputation of freeing a country from oppression decades ago. The MPLA and UNITA opposed each other in this conflict in the 1970s and a civil war that followed.
Remember that more than 60% of Angolans are actually under the age of 25. A historical to them conflict between the MPLA and UNITA holds no water any longer. And many young people are now very pro-opposition, pro-UNITA in many cases.
Kaji says the MPLA is very similar to Southern Africa's other two major former freedom fighters turned rulers, South Africa's African National Congress and Zimbabwe's ZANU-PF. Their support's also plummeting.
When liberation movements become political parties, they forget that the loyalties that underpin them as liberation movements, as those who have opposed oppression, discrimination, apartheid, etc., they forget that that legacy isn't going to last forever. And if they don't live up to their promises of a better life for their citizens, that ultimately they're going to come to a stage, as Angola has now, where young people who don't have an internalization of that conflict history are ready to vote for the opposition. Of course, having said that,
Kaji says implementing reforms is the only just path for the MPLA to take to regain popularity.
The object lesson here for liberation movements turned political parties across the continent is they really need to get their act in gear. They really need to divert some of the funds from the resources of the country, in Angola's case, oil, to actually truly improving the lives of the most vulnerable and marginalized. In Angola, poverty is above 50%, and you can therefore understand why the frustrations are so high.
Another top Angola observer, Borges Niamire, says there is, of course, another route for the MPLA to take to remain in power, and it's a frightening one, cracking down even more brutally on opposition and criticism, and continuing to enrich itself as its citizens become even poorer. For VOA News, I'm Darren Taylor in Johannesburg.
You're listening to Africa News Tonight. I'm Nabil Biagio in Washington. For more information on these and other stories from the continent, please see voaafrica.com. There you will find all your favorite VOA radio and TV programs and a whole lot more. For world news, check out voanews.com. Egypt has announced the sale of nearly $40 billion in assets over 4 years to try to revive its economy. Several Gulf countries have jumped at the opportunity and have already spent about $20 billion to acquire public assets. Egypt has been going through a difficult economic period. Foreign exchange reserves are dwindling, and the country is looking for ways to pay off its foreign debt. Mohamed Anwar Sadat, president of the Liberal Egyptian Party Reform and Development, discussed the risky foreign acquisition of profitable Egyptian assets with VOA senior analyst Mohamed Ashinawi.
Simply, we all know that Egypt is through quite a difficult time, politically and, of course, economically. And we have seen that the government have been announcing for this $40 billion sales in assets over the coming 4 years. And we have seen that some of the Gulf countries, of course, they would like to make use of this opportunity by stepping in and trying to acquire and get some of our best projects or assets, banks, industrial companies, fertilizers, and petrochemicals, other things. So my take on this is that we have to be careful because this is very precious assets and it does serve most of Egyptians, and we have to be careful about it because I would have rather preferred that those investors, whether it's sovereign fund or even private companies from the Gulf, that they should have initiated new projects whereby we can have added value, new employments, new markets, but taking over some of the existing successful projects or assets, I see it of no help to Egypt. That's why I was not very happy with this.
According to data published by the World Bank in mid-July, Egypt would have to repay $33 billion in debt, including interest, in the period between March 2022 and March 2023, equivalent to the country's current foreign exchange reserves. How did the Egyptian parliament deal with the debt crisis and the acquisition?
Honestly, the Egyptian parliament have no big say on this. we do have this budget and planning committee who is supposed to oversight and to monitor all, let's say, agreements which Egypt made. But they are not really that strong when it comes to questioning or making life difficult for those economists or government officials in the Ministry of Finance who go for this kind of agreements. So I don't see that the parliament have a big say when it comes to this kind of borrowing money. So I can see that those who are more concerned are the experts, are the intellectuals, politicians. They are the one who is raising the questions. How come we have all this foreign debt, which we are supposed, as you mentioned, to pay back in a very short time, like a year from March 22 to March 23, whether the figure is 33 billion or less, which is representing, I would say, big pressure on Egypt's economy and which making life difficult for any kind of current and future development, especially for the most important services like healthcare, education, and other social justice programs, you know. So it's really quite a difficult situation, although the government is somehow confident that they can deal with this. The government believes that they have the means and the resources that they can deal with all these challenges, which I see it a bit difficult, you know, because we know our resources, we know our different incomes, which is not that great. Although we do have, of course, a big support from the Gulf countries, especially during the last couple of months, they have been positively supporting Egypt, but that will not last. And we have seen that they start to ask for assets, equities, guarantees for their money, you know, whom they are dumping to help Egypt's economic situation.
That was Mohamed Anwar Sadat, president of the Liberal Egyptian Party Reform and Development, speaking with my colleague Mohamed Ashinawi. Today, Egypt and Qatar signed several memoranda of understanding, official media said, as President Abdel Fattah al-Sisi makes his first visit to the Gulf country since the nations healed a diplomatic rift. One memorandum of understanding was between the Qatar Investment Authority and the Sovereign Fund of Egypt. Since Qatar and Egypt mended ties, which had been strained by a regional diplomatic dispute, they have moved quickly to rebuild relations, striking deals worth $50 billion. The visit comes as Egypt seeks further financial support and investment to cushion an economic shock caused by the war in Ukraine. Kenya's newly elected President William Ruto started his first day in office by unveiling a plan to scrap fuel subsidies as a way to deal with the country's mounting debt, standing at roughly $70 billion. In Nairobi, Charles Kanjama, who is a constitutional lawyer, discusses President Ruto's first moves in office and what to expect in the coming months.
We have a number of economic challenges that we are dealing with. One is that there is a strong perception that we have taken on a substantial debt as a country and we need to deal with our debt situation. There is a concern about sustainability of our expenditure framework, national expenditure, because of debt servicing and the other expenses that we're incurring. One of them are the expenses relating to consumption subsidies. So in the last 1 year, the government has been subsidizing fuel because of the escalation of fuel prices and the fluctuation of our foreign currency rates. And in the last few months, the government has also been subsidizing the price of maize flour. And so the government of William Ruto would like to eliminate this subsidy. There has also been a lot of pressure from our multilateral funding partners, in particular the IMF, who have insisted that we need to get rid of these subsidies because they are harming our economic situation. Then on the other hand, he has said that one of the things that has been affecting us economically is that the price of inputs for agriculture have gone up, which is correct. And the most significant is the price of fertilizer, which has doubled in the course of 2 or 3 months.
I will get into his plans to work with farmers just in a second. Most Kenyans are struggling with a high cost of living right now while trying to meet basic daily necessities like food. Is there anything in the Ruto's announced plan to address that?
His analysis is that the way to deal with the price of food is to increase agricultural productivity. That's a medium-term plan. And so to deal with this on the medium term, because we are about to get into the short rains and short rain has a planting season, he wants to reduce the price of agricultural input so that it can increase the output of our staple products like maize and so on, and that should organically then reduce the cost of food items.
Which so will take some time, of course.
It will take at least 3 or 4 months to bear fruit.
One of his early moves in office was also to add 6 more judges to the Kenyan judiciary. How do you interpret that?
So the Judicial Service Commission is the Kenyan organ that has been given the constitutional responsibility of nominating judges who can take up positions in the judiciary. After that nomination, the process goes to the president to appoint the said judge. And there have been 2 court cases that have gone on in court because the former president had refused to appoint 6 of the judges who had been nominated by the Judicial Service Commission. And the court said that the president was improperly exercising his authority and he should appoint them. But the president had declined to do it and he was in court. The Court of Appeal challenging the decision of the High Court in terms of his exercise of authority. So he's trying to send a signal that the independence of the judiciary and the judiciary authority to continue. So that's why he then decided, now that he's the president, to appoint the judges.
More than 50 African environment ministers are gathering in Senegal this week for the African Ministerial Conference on the Environment. Plastics and the harmful burning of waste are high on the agenda, as Anika Hammerschlag reports from Dakar, Senegal.
Titled Africa's Participation in Developing an International...
The conference is taking place in the wake of major flooding and drought throughout the continent, which have aggravated food insecurity, damaged vital infrastructure, and cost fragile economies billions of dollars. On top of these disasters is the issue of plastic pollution and the burning of waste, which releases methane and other harmful gases into the environment. Richard Muning is the Deputy Regional Director of the United Nations Environment Programme's Africa Office.
If that is not addressed, it will not only end up creating inconvenience in cities, but at the same time, the open burning is causing outdoor pollution. And so converting that waste into opportunities, like recycling plastic waste into plastic tiles where young people can actually be able to learn skills, will create jobs.
About 600 million Africans die from air pollution-related illnesses each year, according to the UN Environment Programme. The ministers in attendance will also discuss the development of an international agreement on plastic pollution, a major issue in African countries where waste management systems and anti-littering education are often lacking. Griffin Zocheng is the executive director of the Center for Environmental Justice and Development.
We have to ensure that Africa call out the major causes, the producers who cause the problem of plastic, to take their action in curbing plastic production, removing harmful substances in the production, and looking at the redesign of the product.
John Kerry, the U.S. Special Presidential Envoy for Climate, is expected to attend the conference Wednesday and Thursday to discuss methane emissions, climate adaptation, and waste management. Bagdi Dada is the Executive Director of Gambia's National Environment Agency. Dada says he hopes the event will allow attendees to create meaningful partnerships that span the globe.
It is important for us to work as a team, look at areas of concern, and maximize how best we can work on those issues. Environment has no boundaries. What affects us here also goes to other parts of the world.
The conference will continue through Friday. Annika Hammerschlag for VOA News, Dakar, Senegal.
And that wraps up this edition of African News Tonight. I'm Nabil Biagio in Washington. On behalf of engineer Nelson Lopez and producer Nadia Taha, thank you for tuning in and for choosing The Voice of America.